You knew my father? She looked startled. Oh, no, I didn't. It's going to sound strange, but I just arrived here and I'd heard of him. I've actually been to the Ackersons in New York, and I was going to check and see if there was a potential job up here, and then, of course, I heard what had happened. So I went to the funeral. It was a weird thing to do, I know.
No, no, Harry said. Funerals are public, right? They're not just for people who knew the person who died.
No, really, they kind of are. She smiled, some of her nervousness dissipating.
I guess so, Harry said, smiling back. Don't worry about it. What's your name?
It's Grace. And you? She reached a hand over the counter, and Harry took it, telling her his name. Her hand felt small in his, her fingertips cold. Harry knew she was lying to him, or misleading him, about her reasons for going to the funeral, about her reasons for coming to the store. Had she known his father? And if so, then why was she hiding it?
Why'd you move up here? Harry asked.
I was sick of city life, and I'd been here before, the main coast anyway, so I decided to be impulsive.
She laughed, more like a nervous punctuation mark. Her hair was auburn, bordering on black, and her eyes were blue with a little bit of green in them. She had a small nose that turned up a little at the end, and a narrow mouth with a thin top lip and a plump lower one. She had thick, dark eyebrows and faint freckles on her forehead, and Harry figured she could be anywhere from his age to somewhere in her early 30s.
You just up and moved here without having a job?
Harry said, and immediately regretted how the question sounded.
I did.
Where are you living?
Just up the hill, past the inn. You know that large brick house with the weedy front yard? I'm in there. It's from Airbnb, just a room, my own bedroom, but it's actually bigger than the apartment I rented in New York. What about you? Are you working here now, in the store?
I'm helping out. Probably for the summer, then, I don't know. Maybe move to New York City?
Don't do it, she laughed.
Okay.
Grace's cheeks darkened. She pulled at an unpierced earlobe.
No jobs here, then?
Oh, right. I don't know. It's probably too soon to make decisions about what's going to happen here, but I can find out and let you know.
Okay, that would be good. Kennewick Inn's looking for a hostess, but I thought I'd try here first.
Should I call you?
Sure, she said, and Harry handed her a pen. She turned over an Ackerson's bookmark and wrote her phone number. Thank you. I knew it was a long shot, and I don't expect anything, so
I'll find out and let you know.
Okay. I'm going to browse around a little.
You should.
She wandered off into an aisle where Harry couldn't see her. It was such a strange interaction that for a moment, Harry stood, just going over the conversation in his mind. Something she had said had struck him as particularly odd. For a moment, he couldn't place it, but then it came to him. She'd asked, "Are you working here now, in the store?" How had she known he'd just started working there? Then Harry remembered the funeral, the minister saying something about how proud Bill was of his son, who had recently graduated from college. That must have been it. John came out from the back room.
"Just cracked the last box," he said. "Finally found the Woodhouse editions. There are some firsts, American ones, but still, not an entire loss."
Harry's weariness must have shown on his face, because John said,
"Go home. You've done more than enough here today."
The bell sounded as the door opened. It was Grace, leaving.
"Did you see the woman I was talking with?" Harry asked.
"When? Just now?"
"Yeah, she'd just left."
"Nope. Why?"
Harry told John how she'd been looking for work. He found himself hoping John would say that an extra hire would be good for the store, but he just shook his head.
"I don't think so, do you? We can handle it, especially when Alice decides she wants to come back in and help."
Harry walked slowly home from the store. He wasn't sure he was up for another intimate dinner with Alice and was relieved to see an unfamiliar car, a dark blue Jetta, parked next to his Civic in the driveway. The license plate read, Seashore 7. He thought maybe it was Alice's friend Chrissy, who almost certainly would have a vanity plate. Harry went up to the front door, which was decorated with stained glass, and was about to enter when he peered, instead, through the one unstained piece of glass in the design. He could see partially into the kitchen, where an older woman was standing, her back to the door, but Harry could see that she was still wearing a raincoat and had a bright red scarf wrapped around her head. She was in profile, her lips moving as though she was talking rapidly. She wasn't immediately recognizable. Harry stood for a moment, frozen on the front stoop, trying to decide if it was possible to enter the house and go straight up to his room. Maybe if he opened the door as quietly as possible. But no, the strange woman was only 20 feet away in the kitchen. Harry would have to be introduced. Instead of entering the house, Harry went around to the backyard, where there was an old, dilapidated barn on the property that had been one of the reasons Bill had originally been interested in the house. It was a small barn, unpainted, the wood weathered to the point where there were inch-wide cracks between the planks, but the roof was solid. Bill's plan had been to restore it completely and eventually use it as storage for even more books. That had never happened, of course. Bill's true passion had been the acquisition of books. Finding places to put them was a chore that he only got around to out of desperation. The barn's wide front doors were open, and Harry walked across the muddy yard and stepped inside, letting his eyes adjust to the dark, cool interior. He could hear the flutter of starlings high up in the rafters. In one corner was an old lathe, left by the previous residents. Harry remembered his father taking a look at it, telling him that maybe he'd take up furniture making, and that way he could make his own shelves.
"Can you imagine this place filled with books?" he'd said.
But except for the lathe, plus an assortment of lawn furniture and old dining room chairs, the barn was empty. Harry sneezed. The air in the barn, even with the wide doors flung open, was dusty and still, the floors pocked with bird shit. He wanted to get out of there, but instead of exiting the way he had come, he traversed the barn and stepped through the regular-sized back door. Not ready to go back to the house, Harry sat on the door jamb. There was a view out over the marsh that abutted the property. Harry felt a sudden and revolting sense of pure grief. It swept through him like an attack of nausea, an absolute knowledge that he was all alone and life was meaningless and devoid of joy. His heart fluttered, and for a moment Harry wondered if he was dying, as though his sudden awareness was bringing on some kind of attack. But then he felt a prick on his arm and rubbed at it. He looked down and saw that he'd killed a mosquito, leaving behind a smear of blood. His heart slowed, the terrible thoughts dissipating as rapidly as they had come. Still, he remembered a very stoned conversation he'd had in his dorm room a few months ago. He was with a junior named Tyler, whom Harry had met through the cinema club. They'd been listening to a Sparkle Horse album, and Tyler had suddenly started to talk about how short our time on the planet was, and how, in the blink of an eye, we would be dead, and everyone who ever knew us would be dead. And that was it. He'd spoken as though he was the first person ever to have had or voiced those thoughts. Fortunately, Paul had dropped by, changed the music to a Henry Mancini compilation, and forced Tyler to drink a cocktail. Harry thought of that conversation now, thought of how the deaths of both his parents had erased a whole portion of his life that existed solely as their memories. He was half gone already. More than half gone. The queasiness and fear returning, Harry made himself stand up. He walked back through the barn and to the front of the house. The car was still there, but the woman he'd seen in the kitchen was now standing on the front stoop, framed in the doorway, saying goodbye to Alice.
Harry, this is Viv. I don't know if you two have met.
The woman turned to Harry, her dark eyes searching his face. She was very thin, her cheeks hollowed out, and suddenly the headscarf made sense. She must be sick with cancer, going through chemotherapy.
I'm sorry about your father, Harry, she said, her voice an unsurprising rasp. I'm afraid I missed the funeral. I've been away.
That's okay, Harry said, then added, thank you.
His voice sounded shaky in his own head, probably because of the intense way she was looking at him. He willed himself to not look down at the ground.
Thank you for coming, Alice said,
gently putting a hand on the small of the woman's back and walking her to the car. The woman moved fast, as though to escape Alice's touch, and got into the car without saying anything else. Harry stepped into the house, and there was the smell of cooking. The table was set for two again. Chapter 13. Then. Alice didn't see Gina again that summer, not after the time they went swimming. She had denied that she was sleeping with Jake, of course, but it was painfully clear that Gina didn't believe her, especially when, after they'd come in from the water, Jake had acted so strange, insisting on wrapping Alice's towel around her. He'd also stared a little too long at Gina, barely covered by Alice's bikini bottoms and the t-shirt plastered to her chest. That fall, Jake and Alice drove to Canada, visiting Montreal and Quebec City.
Almost as good as France, Jake said, and a lot less expensive.
It was one of the few times that Jake ever mentioned money. Alice had always assumed that because Jake worked in a bank and wore nice suits and their condo had a view of the water, they were rich and that money would never be a problem. It didn't matter. Montreal was the most sophisticated place Alice had ever been to. They walked the city in the daytime, stopping into shops, and went to the best restaurants at night. Quebec City was even better, almost magical. They stayed at Le Château Frontenac, more of a castle, really, than a hotel. They ordered wine everywhere they went, and no one ever questioned Alice's age. Maybe some of the hotel staff and waitresses looked at them together and thought they were father and daughter, but no one ever said anything about it. On the final night of their trip, on the boardwalk in Quebec City, Jake put his arm around Alice's shoulders as they walked, something he'd never done before.
Let's come back here next year, Alice said. This is better than France.
Don't you want to visit other cities? You haven't been to New York yet, have you?
Ugh, no thanks, Alice said, thinking of Gina and what it would be like to run into her if she was with Jake.
She still couldn't get the image of Jake and the way he looked at Gina on the beach out of her mind. Over the winter, Alice got a part-time job at a drugstore in Kennewick Center. Jake had brought it up, asking Alice if she was bored just taking classes and spending time at home.
No, not really, she said.
It doesn't bother you that you spend so little time with other people?
Alice frowned and thought about it.
I spend time with professors, and I talk with other students, but you know I'd rather be here with you.
I know, I was just...
He trailed off.
Everything okay?
Everything's great. I just wanted to make sure that everything is great with you as well. Just wanted to make sure you didn't think you were missing out on things other girls your age do, like go to parties and have jobs.
I definitely don't miss going to parties, that's for sure. I hadn't really thought about a job. Do you think I should get one?
I think you should if you want to. You don't need to, obviously, but I had the thought. They're hiring at Bledin's Apothecary.
She'd applied and been hired at the end of her interview by a manager not a whole lot older than she was, a stutterer named Jeff, who was almost skeletally thin. She'd thought she'd hate the job, especially after Jeff informed her that treating customers with respect was her number one priority. But she turned out to love it, even the menial tasks, like restocking the shelves, making sure that everything along the row was displayed neatly and perfectly. She liked this part of the job actually better than running the cash register, but she didn't even mind that. Her favorite part was cashing out at the end of her shift, adding up the register contents against the receipts, making sure it balanced. She didn't mind dealing with the customers, but she didn't like it when people recognized her from high school, either old classmates or past teachers. They always asked her what she was doing now, and she'd say that she was taking classes at MCC, and sometimes, though not often, they'd ask her where she was living, and she would simply say that she was still at home. A couple of times, she saw the memory that her mother had died pass across their features. They would blush or avert their eyes, not knowing what to say. It was awkward, but it didn't last, and most of the time she never saw them again. That was not the case with Mrs. Bergeron, Gina's mother, who came in frequently and always sought out Alice, asking her how she was doing, and telling her all about Gina as though the two of them were still best friends. She had to drop out of NYU because she couldn't keep up with her courses and her modeling schedule at the same time. My husband said that she should have dropped some of her modeling work, but I said, well, she can always go back to school and finish, and she won't always be able to be a model. I mean, strike while the going is good, right? She reminded Alice so much of Gina, the way her words would speed up while she was talking, ending her sentences by taking a deep breath. Once, when Alice was working in the deodorant and body wash aisle, Mrs. Bergeron, visibly elated, approached her holding the latest copy of Cosmopolitan. "You're not going to believe this, Alice," she said, thumbing the issue open to an ad for Jordache, and there was Gina, in high-cut shorts and long socks, with two other girls in what was supposed to be a high school cafeteria. The ad was selling a new line of knitted socks, and Mrs. Bergeron said, "She also did a session for jeans, but doesn't know if they're going to use those pictures yet. Can you believe it?" Alice did believe it. She'd always known Gina was going to be a star, but shook her head at Mrs. Bergeron and said, "Amazing." "I know, right? I might have to buy every last copy." Gina's mother ended up buying most of the copies, but not quite all of them, and Alice took one home with her, first reading the magazine cover to cover while Jake watched a hockey game, then later, cutting out the ad and hiding it in the desk in her old bedroom. She kept wondering if Gina was happy and if she had a nice boyfriend now that she was a model. It was a possibility, but she doubted it. Gina looked very skinny in the ad, and Alice wondered what kinds of drugs she was taking. Over the following year, Gina went from appearing in the Jordache socks ad with two other models to appearing in a denim campaign all by herself, wearing skin-tight jeans and an unbuttoned silk blouse. Mrs. Bergeron informed Alice that Gina had started to book runway shows and magazine layouts and was going by the professional name of simply Bijou. "You should visit her, Alice," she would say. "She'd love that." "I'm pretty busy up here," Alice would reply. "I'm sure they'd let you take a few days off from work, and your stepfather, he wouldn't care if you spent some time in New York, would he?" Whenever Mrs. Bergeron mentioned Jake, always calling him your stepfather, Alice could hear the disdain in her voice. It was obvious that Gina had told her mother that she thought Alice was sexually involved with Jake, and that her mother disapproved. "I have school, too," Alice said. "Not in the summer, you don't. Look, if it's money, I'd be happy to buy you a train ticket to go down. Tell the truth, you'd be doing me and Don a favor, just to have you check on her. She could use a friend from home, I'm sure." "I'll think about it," Alice always said, the words that would end the conversation. In truth, Mrs. Bergeron's pleas to Alice to visit her daughter in New York made Alice feel good. It was clear that something was wrong, that the modeling life wasn't all nice restaurants and handsome men and glittering New York parties. Was Gina falling apart? Alice began to imagine visiting her, finding her drug-addicted and abused in some grungy loft apartment downtown like the ones in Desperately Seeking Susan. Gina would be miserable, track marks up and down her arms, constantly crying. This became one of Alice's favorite stories to tell herself, so much so that she began to seriously consider visiting Gina in New York, to make it actually happen. She never went, but in early fall, before the beginning of her junior year at college, Mrs. Bergeron came into the drugstore to tell Alice that Gina was coming home for a few weeks, that she was simply exhausted from all the work and needed a break. "You'll come over some night, won't you, Alice?"
"I'll think about it," she said.
"Okay," Mrs. Bergeron said, "but I'm going to keep asking whether you'll like it or not."
She waved a finger at Alice, but she was smiling, an impossibly wide, toothy grin that Gina had inherited. She did keep asking, and finally Alice relented, a Friday night in late September, because both Mrs. Bergeron and Gina showed up at the drugstore and begged her to come over for dinner that night.
"Do you have plans?" Gina asked. "If you have plans, then..."
Alice did have plans, but only with Jake. It was a Friday night, which meant he would return home with flowers or a nice bottle of wine. Sometimes he would stop at the new video store that had opened up over in York and pick out a movie to watch. But even so, he'd probably be okay with Alice going to dinner at the Bergerons. Well, not okay, exactly, but he'd be stoic about it. Alice just wanted to go in order to get it over with. If she didn't go tonight, they would keep pestering her.
"Okay, I'll come tonight," she said.
"Yay!"
both Gina and her mother said at the same time.
"God, it's Sloppy Joe's tonight, but they're homemade, at least," Mrs. Bergeron said. "My favorite," Gina said, stretching out the vowels.
That night, Jake came back from the bank with a large bottle of white Zinfandel, but no flowers and no movie. He seemed tired, and when Alice told him she was thinking of going over to the Bergerons for dinner, he made a face but didn't say anything negative. Right before she left, however, he said to her,
"You won't tell them anything, will you? About us?"
"I won't, but don't you think, I mean... it's been 2 years, and I'm a grown woman now."
"Trust me, Alice. They won't understand. They'll think that I'm taking advantage of you. We live in America. We were founded by Puritans. In other countries, they would totally understand what was going on between us, but not here."
"I won't tell them anything. I wouldn't have, anyway. It's none of their business."
Alice drove Jake's car across town, listening to the tape he'd left in the deck. It was Genesis, Phil Collins singing the word "mama" over and over again. She got tired of it and sped ahead to "That's All." After she pulled into the Bergeron's driveway, she listened to the rest of the song, the sky a deep, dusky blue over the Bergeron's house, its first floor brick and its second story painted yellow, the windows with black shutters. The front yard was brown from the summer drought, and with a scattering of orange pine needles. As the song finished, Alice wondered if tonight was the beginning of the story of Gina's fall from grace. What had Gina's mother said? That she was exhausted? Alice shut the car off. Gina didn't seem exhausted during dinner. If anything, she seemed a little hyper, constantly interrupting anything anyone else was saying to get her own word in, pushing her food around the plate, cutting her sloppy joe into bite-sized pieces with her knife and fork, something the rest of the family made fun of her for.
"You want chopsticks for that, G?"
her father asked.
"She eats sushi now,"
he said to Alice.
"Everyone eats sushi, Dad," Gina said.
"Not in Maine. We cook our fish up here."
"High five,"
Gina's youngest sister said, and slapped Mr. Bergeron's palm. Alice kept mostly silent during the meal, except when she was asked direct questions, either about her job at the drugstore or the courses she was taking at MCC. No one asked her about Jake and what he was up to, at least not at the dinner table. She felt strange during dinner, Not uncomfortable, exactly, but like an alien that had been dropped into a typical American family, full of inside jokes and overlapping conversation. It was different, so much louder than what she was used to with Jake, just the two of them, everything perfect and civilized. A small part of her was jealous, only because there was something relaxing about not always being the center of attention, not always having eyes on you. But then Alice looked at Gina, the way her eyes were darting between the members of her family, her fingers tugging on one of her earlobes till it had turned an angry red, and she thought, no, family life is messy and unpredictable. Who would want that? After dinner, when the two youngest girls were tasked with clearing the table, Alice caught Gina giving her mother a quick glance, then saying awkwardly, "New rule, the grown women get the night off cleaning."
"New rule?" Mr. Bergeron said.
Gina was standing.
"Come on, Alice, let's go outside a minute."
"Gotta get her fix," said Gina's younger sister, pantomiming, taking a puff of a cigarette.
"I'll come too," said Mrs. Bergeron, as Alice rose from the table, suddenly nervous.
It was balmy outside for September, the dark sky filled with stars. Gina did light up a cigarette before the back screen door slammed shut, then took a seat on one of the patio chairs. She offered the pack to Alice, who turned it down.
"Smart girl," said Mrs. Bergeron, leaning against the outdoor table.
Alice sat next to Gina on the very edge of a chair. She said how much she'd enjoyed dinner, then immediately asked about Gina's oldest brother, Howie, who hadn't been there that night. She just wanted to keep asking questions to avoid the discussion that she felt was coming. Mrs. Bergeron said that Howie was doing the backpack thing in Europe, and she wondered if he'd ever return. While she spoke, Alice felt Gina's eyes on her. She turned toward her just as she was snuffing the butt of her cigarette out against the bottom of her sandal.
"You should," Alice began, but Gina interrupted her. "Alice, I want to talk about Jake."
"So do I," said Mrs. Bergeron.
"Okay," said Alice. She could feel the blood rushing into her face, her skin heating up. "We both think it's really strange that you're still living with him," Gina said, removing another cigarette from her pack of Parliaments. "I know that he's your stepdad, but it's not like he was with your mom for a really long time. You've lived with him longer than he lived with your mother."
"Where else am I supposed to go?" Alice said, anger causing her chest to tighten and her words to come out sounding slightly pinched.
"I don't have a family. He pays for my classes, Gina."
"We're not judging you, honey," Mrs. Bergeron said. "We're worried that Jake is taking advantage of you, and if he is, we want you to know that you have options."
"What do you mean?" Gina said. "You remember Maddie, right? She said she saw you at a restaurant in Portland with Jake and that you were acting like a couple."
"What does she mean, we were acting like a couple?"
"That doesn't matter," Mrs. Bergeron said. "What we want to know is that you are comfortable with whatever situation you're in. That's all. If you tell us that you and Jake are happy together, I mean, who are we?"
"I don't care if you're happy together," Gina said, shouting a little. "It's gross, Alice. You're a young, beautiful girl, and you let that fucking creep have his way with you."
"Gina," said Mrs. Bergeron. Alice stood up. She felt tears pricking at her eyes and really didn't want to cry. She quickly scanned the fenced backyard, like a cat looking for an exit, then began to walk toward the latched door that led onto the driveway. Gina ran after her.
"Sorry, Alice, come back. We just want to talk with you."
Alice kept walking, not trusting her voice. When she reached the door, Gina grabbed her shoulder. Alice, without thinking, spun and grabbed Gina's hand, pulling it to her mouth and biting down at the base of Gina's thumb. Gina screamed and yanked her hand back. For a moment, they both stood there, Gina grasping her hand, and Alice frozen, shocked that she'd actually bitten Gina. Mrs. Bergeron had jumped up after hearing Gina scream and was coming toward them, saying, "What is it? What happened?" Alice pushed through the door and ran to the car. She could taste Gina's blood in her mouth,
When she got back home, Jake was still up, glassy-eyed, watching television, a snifter of brandy on one of his knees.
How was it?
He asked. Fine, Alice said.
What did they serve?
Sloppy Joe's, she said, and Jake smiled. It was kind of a scene, honestly, everyone talking over everyone else. I missed being here.
Well, you're here now,
Jake said, adjusting the chair so that he could get out of it comfortably, almost spilling his drink.
Let's get into bed.
Alice went up the stairs, feeling good about controlling her feelings in front of Jake. During the drive back in the car, she told herself that she'd barely even bitten Gina, that her teeth had only just broken the skin and that it had been Gina's fault anyway. Gina was the one who'd grabbed her violently, and she had just been trying to get away. It was nothing. And then she told herself that the conversation in the backyard hadn't actually happened, and that the night was merely annoying. If she believed that, it kept the anger she felt toward Gina from rising up in her and making her want to scream. She brushed her teeth, then changed into pajama bottoms and a threadbare t-shirt. Under the covers, she carefully composed her body, shut her eyes, and began to try to relax. It had been a nice dinner at Gina's family's house, nothing more. But the words she'd tried to erase kept coming back. Gina calling Jake that fucking creep. Mrs. Bergeron's condescending tone, talking to Alice like she was some little girl. And then she remembered the feeling when she'd bitten down on Gina's hand. Her body was so tight that it was beginning to tremble. While Jake was applying his face cream in the bathroom, Alice slid out from the covers and got off the bed. "Want anything from downstairs?" she asked Jake, and he shook his head. In the kitchen, she made herself a white Russian, heavy on the vodka, and told herself to drink it slowly, to not be like her mother. She drank half of it in short, small sips, and began to feel better. Of course they'd be critical. They didn't know what she had with Jake. Or maybe they did know and were just jealous. That made a lot more sense. As she was making herself a second drink, she heard a very light tapping and thought for a moment that Jake was coming down the stairs. She stepped out into the living room. There was the tapping sound again, and she realized someone was knocking on the door. She went and peered through the eye hole. It was Gina. Chapter 14. Now. Every time the front doorbell rang at the store the following day, Harry thought it might be Grace returning to find out more about a possible job. He didn't really believe she'd return. Why would she when he'd told her he would call? But he found himself disappointed anyway. He'd been obsessing over their conversation the previous afternoon, telling himself that maybe she was just what she said she was, new in town, looking for a job. But she wasn't, was she? She had obviously come in for some purpose other than a job. Why else would she have been at the funeral and walking past the house on his first night back in Maine? But each time the bell rang, it was either a customer, usually coming to offer condolences instead of buying a book, or Alice, who stopped by at lunchtime to bring chicken sandwiches and then again mid-afternoon, because she was shopping and wanted to see if Harry or John needed anything. Dinner at home the previous night had been less intimate and less awkward than the night before, but only because Harry told her he wasn't feeling well, passed on a drink, and ate in record time. He spent the evening in his room, finishing the Ed McBain and starting another, but mostly just thinking about his father and what might have happened on the path that afternoon. He also thought of Alice, sexualized images of her flashing unwanted through his mind. He kept picturing her from that first summer when she was married to his father, the green bikini top and the denim shorts, so short that he could see the bottom curve of her buttocks. He realized that 4 years of college hadn't managed to shake that image from his mind. At 4:30, when it became clear that Grace wasn't going to drop by the store again, he got out his phone and punched in her number, adding it as a contact. He was about to call her, but decided to text instead.
"This is Harry from the bookstore. Want to get a drink tonight?"
He pressed send, wondering anxiously if he was misleading her about the job possibility. Lou leapt onto Harry's lap, startling him. Lou was not generally a lap cat, unless you'd ignored him for some time, and then he'd find a way to pounce into your lap when you weren't looking. With one hand, Harry stroked Lou's matted fur, writing another text to Grace with his other.
"No job here, at least not yet. Just wanted to get a drink."
He shook his head rapidly at the two dumb texts.
"You okay, my friend?" John asked.
Lou flattened himself onto Harry's lap, purring.
"Oh, sorry. I'm looking at my phone."
Harry held it up, and as he did, it vibrated in his hand. It was Grace, texting back.
"Sure. When?"
They agreed to meet at the Village Inn in 1 hour. Harry left work early, considered going home to change out of his black t-shirt into something a little more date-like, then decided his time would be better spent waiting for Grace at the bar. The Village Inn was a large colonial house refurbished into a small hotel. Harry had been inside a few times to eat dinner with his father or his father and Alice. He'd seen the bar, but he'd never had a drink there. It was a small alcove off the main lobby, wood-paneled and with just 8 padded stools along the bar. It was empty when Harry arrived, not even a bartender. He sat on a stool. The oak bar gleamed with polish, and low lighting illuminated the high-end bottles displayed behind the bar. Harry was used to college bars, with Budweiser mirrors and Jägermeister dispensers. While he was trying to decide what to drink, the bartender came out. She was a heavy-set woman with old-timey tattoos on both arms. Her hair was dyed a bottle blonde, and she wore thick glasses. She startled a little when she saw Harry.
"Where'd you come from, sweetie?" she said,
and Harry asked her if they were open yet.
"We're open. What can I get you? And can I see an ID, please?"
Harry fished out his driver's license, showed it to the bartender, and ordered himself a bourbon and ginger ale. She made his drink in a low tumbler, garnishing it with a thin sliver of lemon, then fiddled with her phone, which was attached to the speakers, selecting a song, a man's deep voice over drums, bass, and a saxophone. Harry looked at his own phone as she began to prepare the bar, shifting bottles around, cutting up fruit. It was half an hour before Grace was due to show up. Harry told himself to sip his drink and make it last. He was anxious to see Grace again, and he wondered what she thought about his invitation. He didn't know what to think of it himself. Had he invited her out on a date? Or was he trying to find out what connection she might have had with his father? Both, probably, although it was easier for Harry to consider it a fact-finding mission. Harry had had 2 major relationships in college. The first had been with Florence Lee, a girl he'd met his first week at Mather, when they were both volunteers at the student-run movie theater. Their first night together, they had stayed up till dawn talking about the French New Wave and Vonnegut novels. She'd done most of the talking, actually, but it was like she was speaking both his thoughts and her own out loud. The next night, they stayed up till dawn having sex. Those 2 nights combined to convince Harry that Florence Lee was the one and only true love of his life. They were inseparable, until the following spring, when Harry discovered that she'd never stopped fucking her high school boyfriend back on Long Island. Harry had been inconsolable, even considering leaving Mather. Paul Roman, claiming he'd never liked Florence, had finally gotten Harry out of the funk. Then Harry had started spending time with Paul's friend Kim, so different from the cerebral, depressive, highly sexual Florence. She was a very sarcastic theater major who wore retro dresses and smoked American spirits. They stayed close all through sophomore year, Harry coaching Kim through her own complicated, emotionally abusive relationship with a fellow theater major named Antoine. When Kim finally shed Antoine at the beginning of junior year, Harry and Kim started fooling around, jokingly at first. They agreed to keep it quiet, and they agreed to take it slow, each having been damaged by previous sexual relationships.
"How slow?" Harry asked,
the first morning after Kim had spent the night in his bed.
"When it snows, we'll do it. How about that?"
Harry pulled up his dorm room's blind and looked out at a blue sky. It was early November, and most of the trees were still holding on to their changed leaves.
"First snow? Really?"
"Sure. Sounds about right. When it snows, I'll let you put your penis in my vagina."
She was hooking her bra behind her back and smiling widely.
"Promise?"
"I promise."
By the middle of December, there hadn't been so much as a snow squall, and the weathermen were predicting a decidedly non-white Christmas. The mild fall had become a constant joke between Harry and Kim, the weather conspiring to keep them apart. On the last night of fall semester, Harry had one paper left to write, 5 pages on the Protestant Reformation. He was just finishing up when he received a text from Kim.
"Done yet?"
"Almost."
"Come over when you're finished."
After giving the paper one last reread, then emailing it to his professor, Harry wrapped a scarf around his neck and walked across campus to Kim's single in Hubbard Hall. It was cold, the sky filled with stars. He checked his watch before knocking on her door. It was just past midnight, but he knew she'd still be up. She opened the door, her eyes bright and nervous. Harry walked into a room entirely plastered in cut-out snowflakes. It must have been hundreds, taped to the walls, the ceiling, even scattered on the floor.
"Ta-da!"
she said, her voice quavering, and Harry knew instantly that the waiting had been a mistake. He felt it in his stomach, and put a smile on his face that he hoped looked genuine. Kim threw him onto the bed, also covered in snowflakes, and told him to make love to her, and Harry felt all desire leave his body. Whether it was the gimmickry of the moment, or the fact that he'd never had intense feelings for Kim in the first place, he knew it wasn't going to work. Still, he tried, and by dawn, when it was clear that nothing was going to happen, he pretended to fall asleep, listening to Kim quietly cry into the pillow next to him. The following semester, Harry and Kim agreed to just be friends. It was awkward for a while, but eventually they went back to the way they'd been before. Harry told himself that their failed consummation had been a product of a mismatch, that they never should have tried. But secretly, he worried about it. Was he only sexually attracted to the girls who didn't want him, or to the women he could never have, like his stepmother? Toward the end of senior year, Harry and Kim had begun to occasionally fool around again, and one night, Kim, as drunk as he'd ever seen her, told him that he was the only boy she'd ever loved. Harry responded with silence. The following day, Kim claimed she'd blacked out the night before, but Harry wasn't so sure. He told himself he needed to stop misleading her, and he had, for the most part. But now it didn't matter. She was doing Teach for America for a year in Baton Rouge, and Harry was in Maine.
"Same again?"
the bartender asked.
Sure,
Harry said, checking the time on his watch. It was exactly the time that Grace and he had agreed on. He turned, and there she was, walking into the bar, wearing a dark blue dress, the hemline over her knees.
"Fancy,"
she said, looking around as she slid onto the stool next to Harry. The bartender placed his drink in front of him and asked Grace what she wanted. She glanced toward the small selection of draft beers and ordered a shock top.
Any luck on the job front?
Not yet. I'm not in a rush, though. How's the bookstore?
Harry, partly from nerves, found himself telling Grace not just about the work he'd been doing at the store, but also about his anxiety regarding the store's future. His own future, as well.
You're not interested in taking over? Grace asked.
No, not really. And if I was, I'd be interested in working at the Ackersons in New York, even though it doesn't belong to my father... didn't belong to him anymore. I guess I'm not interested in living up here in Maine with Alice for the rest of my life.
Alice is your stepmom?
Yes, sorry. She's my father's second wife. My mother died when I was in high school.
So what's Alice like?
Grace had finished her beer and must have signaled the bartender because a full one was being placed in front of her, along with a small bowl of Chex Mix.
She's...
Harry searched for a word, finally coming up with...
Fine.
Grace laughed.
Faint praise.
Honestly, I just don't know her that well. She married my father just as I was getting ready to head off to college. It was pretty much all about me then, and I didn't really bother to get to know her.
A flash of his father's young bride in her bikini went through Harry's mind.
At least, not in any significant way. She's very sincere, and that's always made me a little bit uncomfortable. My father was always closed off about his emotions. My mother, not so much, but she was also sarcastic, and that goes a long way. Alice doesn't really have a sense of humor. I sometimes think my father fell in love with her because she reminded him of Maine, and he really wanted to return here.
Why did she remind him of Maine?
I don't know. She's straightforward, not complicated or neurotic. She's old-fashioned. She took care of him the way his mother took care of him, maybe. That makes him sound terrible.
Not really,
she said, licking some foam from her upper lip.
Tell me about yourself,
Harry said, sipping at his drink, surprised to find it was nothing but ice.
Do I have to? Grace said, and laughed.
You don't have to do anything. I'm just curious. How old are you?
You're not supposed to ask that, but I don't mind. I'm 25.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Michigan, then I went to school in New York City, and now I live right here in Kennewick, Maine.
And you dream of working in a bookstore?
Truth is, like I told you, I know the Ackersons in New York City. I used to live on the same block and go in all the time. I like old books, and I knew that there was a second Ackersons here, and that's partly why I picked Kennewick. Not to work at the bookstore, although obviously I would love to do that, but because I wanted to move to the coast of Maine, and when I found out that the bookstore on my block had a sister store in Kennewick, it felt like fate. That's why I picked here, and that's why I went to your father's funeral. You look like you don't believe me.
Do I? No. Keep going.
But Harry had been having trouble believing her. Her story sounded rehearsed, and as she told it, her eyes shifted back and forth, never settling on any one point. She was lying.
That's it. That's my story.
Why did you leave New York?
Why do you think?
Boy troubles?
Ah, that's one way to put it, but yes, that is why I left New York.
The bartender asked Harry if he wanted another drink. He hadn't eaten since the chicken sandwich at lunch, and the two bourbon and ginger ales had felt pretty strong. He ordered a beer instead, the same kind that Grace was drinking. After serving it with an orange slice on the rim of the pint glass, the bartender pointed a remote and turned on the flat-screen television built into the bar. Red Sox players were running onto the field at Fenway.
You a baseball fan?
Grace asked, clearly hoping to change the subject.
Fair weather, I guess. When the Red Sox make the playoffs, I start to pay attention. My dad was a huge fan.
And suddenly Harry realized that his father would never see another Red Sox game again, never read another box score or complain about a pitcher.
How about you?
Not really. I'm a football fan, soccer fan. I mean, I follow Maine United.
How did that happen?
Harry asked. He listened to her talk about soccer, how she'd played her whole life, and how she'd started watching the Premier League games when they'd begun airing them on American television 10 years earlier. She talked about players as though Harry had heard of them. Now that she wasn't hiding anything, she was making eye contact, and her voice had altered slightly. She'd relaxed, and Harry could see her at 15, a feisty, freckled soccer player with long, dark hair on some playing field in the Midwest. Harry finished his beer and ate the orange slice. You hungry? Grace asked.
I am. I should go home, probably, because I'm sure that Alice has cooked a 3-course meal. It's what she's been doing since my father died.
I should eat something, too.
I'd invite you, but...
No, no, please. I have food at home. I should get going as well. Outside, it was still light, but the sun was hidden behind a bank of dark clouds coming in from the west. There was a distant roll of thunder.
I'll walk you home,
Harry said. You don't have to.
It's sort of on my way.
They walked up the hill from the village, stopping outside the large red brick Victorian where Grace had rented the room. There was an old Mazda RX-7 in the driveway, and Harry wondered if it was hers. Let's do this again, Grace said, as a few fat drops of rain started to hit the sidewalk.
I'd like that, Harry said.
He turned and began to walk toward home, wondering if he'd get there before it really began to rain hard, when he heard Grace's footsteps following him. Wait up, she said, and he turned. For one brief moment, Harry thought she was going to keep coming and kiss him, but she stopped, a little breathless, and said, I did know your father, a little bit, from down in New York, from Ackerson's.
Oh, Harry said.
I felt bad lying to you about it.
Why did you?
I don't know. I didn't want you to think... We didn't know each other well.
That's okay.
Good night again, she said, walking backward, smiling, nodding her head slowly, a gesture that seemed to say that she felt better now that she'd told the truth. But she hadn't told the truth. At least not the whole truth. Harry was sure of that. Chapter 15. Then. They sat on the beach together, up near the wall, each on one of the flat stones that clustered along the high tide mark. It was high tide now, an occasional wave lapping at their feet. Gina had wanted to come inside the condominium, but Alice had stepped out through the door, pulling it shut behind her, and said that they should go talk on the beach. It was clear that Gina was either drunk or seriously messed up on some kind of drug. Her eyes were red-rimmed and unfocused, and her words sounded gluey in her mouth. Alice held her arm as they walked toward the water.
I'm sorry, Al, Gina said. But I had to say something, because if I hadn't, then I'd keep thinking it, but now it's ruined us, and you're my only friend in Kennewick, only real friend, and now you hate me.
I don't hate you, Alice said.
You don't know what it's like in New York. I, like, don't trust anyone. Anyone. Everyone tells me I'm beautiful, and everyone tells me how I'm this big star, but I'm not, Al. Marjorie, you know Marjorie?
Alice didn't, but nodded anyway. They were near the beach, the ocean's pulsing roar muffling Gina's words. Alice let her talk. She told a long, rambling story about her manager, Marjorie, and how she thought Marjorie was the only one she could trust, but how it turned out that she couldn't trust anyone. While she spoke, Alice looked at Gina's hand where she had bitten her. It was swaddled in a white bandage, and even in the dim moonlight, Alice could see dark spots where the blood was seeping through. I did that, she thought. She remembered what it felt like, her teeth sinking into Gina's flesh.
But I trust you, Gina was saying, and that's why I can't lose you, Al. I can't lose you, and I don't care what you're doing with your mom's husband. That's not my business, and I should never have brought it up. I mean, do what you want, right?
We're not doing anything.
Hey, I get it, Al. He's hot. I'd do it with him.
For a brief moment, Gina's words provoked in Alice an urge to pick up the nearest rock and drive it into Gina's face. Instead, she said, "Let's go swimming." Gina swiveled her head toward the black expanse of the ocean, almost as though she was just realizing that it was there.
"Really?" she said.
"Sure. Why not?"
"It'll be freezing."
"It won't be. You're just scared. It'll be amazing." Gina stared toward the water for a moment, then said,
"Sure. Okay."
She smiled, leaning in toward Alice. Her breath had an almost chemical smell to it, like rubbing alcohol. She stood.
"Let's go swimming. It can be symbolic, like our fresh start."
She pushed her jeans down her long legs, almost slipping on the rocks, then pulled her shirt and sweater over her head. Alice, still wearing just the pajama bottoms and the t-shirt, pulled them off, feeling awkward and exposed but wanting to get into the water. Gina's eyes quickly scanned Alice's naked body, and Alice resisted the urge to cover her breasts, which suddenly seemed awkward and fleshy next to Gina's flat chest and small, dark nipples.
"I can't believe we're doing this," Gina said. "It's going to be freezing."
She pulled the bandage off her hand and tossed it on the sand. "The water's probably warmer than the air right now," Alice said, stepping from the rocks onto the hard-packed wet sand. As soon as she was ankle-high in the water, she realized the water temperature was probably exactly the same temperature as the air. It felt like stepping into nothing. She waded out, and Gina flew past her, spinning her arms and screaming, crashing into the surf.
"Chicken!"
she yelled back at Alice. Alice kept wading forward. Everything was dark except for the foam of the breaking surf. A large wave was rolling toward her, and Alice dove under it, swam underwater, then came up next to Gina.
"This feels fucking amazing," Gina said, tilting her head back so that her hair was in the water.
Alice found herself annoyed to share the sentiment. She'd never swum naked before, and the grasp of the ocean water on her skin made her feel incredibly alive. "Let's see how far we can swim out," she said.
"Maybe we'll get eaten by sharks," Gina said, then laughed drunkenly, swallowing some water, then coughing it out.
Alice took a deep breath, filling her lungs, feet planted on the dense sandy bottom. The moon emerged from behind a cloud and shone silver on the water. "No, it will be great. Trust me." Alice began to swim, Gina beside her. She went slow, not wanting Gina to fall behind. The water turned colder and calmer the farther out they went. She could hear Gina starting to breathe hard, snorting out water as she turned her head every other stroke. "You okay?" Alice asked.
"Yeah, a little tired."
Gina spun onto her back, her breath sounding ragged. "If we go a little farther, there's a sandbar."
"Yeah, let's keep going,"
Gina said, spinning and beginning to swim again, her arms slapping the water. Alice remembered what Gina had been like at cross-country practices, always willing to slow down if Alice was behind, but always making sure that she would be first to finish. Alice swam by her side. She was beginning to breathe heavily too, but her arms felt strong, slicing through the water, propelling her. She felt like she could swim forever. She sped a little ahead of Gina, steadily moving away from shore, the water now much colder.
"Stop! Hold up!"
Gina yelled, her voice hoarse, and Alice stopped, spun, and swam back toward her. The lights along the shore seemed far away and insignificant.
"I think I'm cramping," Gina said, and there was some panic in her voice.
"Just rest for a moment," Alice said.
"Have you felt the sandbar yet?"
"I haven't, but I remember it, unless it's moved." Doggy paddling, Alice could feel the water tugging at her legs. She'd wondered if they'd hit a rip current, and it felt as though they had. There really had been a sandbar out this far from Kennewick Beach, but that had changed after the storm-filled winter the year after they graduated.
"I shouldn't have come out this far," Gina said, her chin submerged in the water, the words sputtering.
No worries. We'll rest a bit, then turn back.
Okay.
Alice, staying afloat just by scissoring her legs, said, I am having sex with him, you know, with that fucking creep. The moon was back behind a cloud, and it was dark again.